Hello there and welcome. Today is Tuesday, August the 16th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, Russian warplanes use Iranian airbase to stage Syrian airstrikes.
The Commission is gravely concerned for the safety of civilians, including a reported 100,000 children.
Donald Trump calls for extreme vetting for those wanting to emigrate to the United States. Also ahead, the Olympics of classical music. It's all on today's International Edition. And we begin with the U.S. presidential campaign. Donald Trump says if elected, he would end our current strategy of, quote, nation building and regime change because they don't work. His dislike for nation building is shared by many, including the target of his criticism, President Barack Obama. In fact, it was Obama's predecessor, Republican George W. Bush, who committed the U.S. to large-scale nation building projects in Iraq and Afghanistan. Obama discarded that strategy. Trump also calling on Monday for extreme ideological vetting of immigrants and vowing to significantly overhaul the country's screening process and block those who sympathize with extremist groups or don't embrace American values.
To put these new procedures in place, we will have to temporarily suspend immigration from some of the most dangerous and volatile regions of the world that have a history of exporting terrorism. Not for us.
Also on Monday, Trump's Democratic rival Hillary Clinton had some help on the campaign trail. She was joined by Vice President Joe Biden at a rally in his hometown of Scranton, Pennsylvania. Biden telling the crowd he believes electing Donald Trump would be a bad idea.
Trump's ideas are not only profoundly wrong, they're very dangerous and they're very un-American. They reveal a profound ignorance of our Constitution. It's a recipe for playing into the hands, and I will end this because you've been standing so long. It's a recipe for playing in the hands of terrorists and their propaganda.
An average of recent national polls indicates Clinton has a lead of nearly 7 percentage points over Trump. While the general election is proving tough for him, Trump did win handily in primary after primary against a big field of competitors. His success largely led by white working class voters who are not dissuaded by media scrutiny of their candidate. So why are they so drawn to Trump? Well, I talked about it with Justin Guest, assistant professor of public policy at George Mason University's School of Public Policy and author of the book The New Minority: Why White Working Class Politics in an Age of Immigration and Inequality.
Yeah, Donald Trump has a very clear constituency that is numerous, and it was numerous enough to help him win the Republican primaries, particularly because it was such an extraordinarily crowded field of candidates that if you had a plurality, a sizable minority of the voting public, you were going to do well enough because the votership was divided between 15 other candidates. The real question for Donald Trump is whether it will be enough to rely on that same constituency in order to win a general election with only one competitor. And I think that the conventional wisdom and, frankly, the math says that it's not. So the challenge that he now has in front of him is how does he build a Trump coalition with the backbone being white working class men, but not as many white working class women as well, along with other constituencies that add up to enough votes to win.
The one thing that has been clear is that the people that do follow him seem to be extremely loyal to him and are not bothered by any of the controversial statements that he makes.
That's absolutely right. And the reason why, Lori, is because these are folks who are not used to being represented publicly, affectionately, and affirmatively by mainstream politicians over the last 40 years. There was an era in American politics where the white working class was the heart and soul of the electorate, where politicians outwardly sought out their votes. And over the last 40 years, as their numbers have diminished, as their power in unions have diminished, fewer and fewer politicians actually do that. So when someone like Donald Trump, with all of his status and all of his celebrity, says, I care specifically about you, it's going to win you a lot of fans amongst a group of people who would otherwise felt really marginalized.
His opponent and opponents would argue that while these people may feel like he is in their corner, it's just not so. What do the facts say?
There have been many allegations that white working class people vote irrationally, that they don't vote with their interests. And I can tell you that that is wholly untrue. White working class know precisely why they're voting for Donald Trump. It's just not rational from the perspective of people who are not white working class. Rationality is really very much a subjective phenomenon, right? There are certain forms of rationality depending on the lens that you take. And many of the folks who accuse right working class people of being irrational are usually looking through an economic lens. Now, that was, I think, especially true given white working class support of Republicans in earlier election cycles. But in this election cycle, Donald Trump speaks economically to many white working class people in light of his protectionist economic policies, at least from a trade perspective. And so they see that as a clear way of supporting their economic prospects. From a social perspective, many white working class people feel that they are ultimately disadvantaged in the very countries that they once defined. And Donald Trump speaks to that as well. And so whether or not it's right, whether it's racist, that's going to be debated. And many people, I think, quite rightfully think it is. However, ultimately, from a white working class person's perspective, the rational choice is Donald Trump. And it's just very hard for many cosmopolitans, many liberals, many authors and people in the media to accept.
So even when he's blustery or when he makes boastful comments about himself, what I'm hearing is they actually like that about him.
In some cases, they're going to like it. And, it's hard to generalize across all of his supporters. Many of them may like that confidence, that brashness, that nationalism that comes from it. And they want to feel like America is strong, and they feel strong through his expressions of strength, whether it's bravado and fluffery. However, for others, they may not like it, and they may feel discomforted by it, but they are sufficiently persuaded by his policy proposals and general rhetoric that they will vote for him despite that.
Let's talk about your book that's coming out in September, The New Minority, White Working Class Politics in an Age of Immigration and Inequality. I imagine it really taps into this very issue.
Absolutely. It's funny. This is a book that I started writing 5 years ago when Donald Trump was just a somewhat unsuccessful but very popular businessman. The idea that he would be running for president or that the United Kingdom would one day leave the European Union, because I studied both the United States and the United Kingdom in this book, those prospects were very, very far-fetched. I studied this group of people because I was interested in their sense of marginality, given all the ironies in their demographic dominance and power dominance over the last century or so in their country. They became very, very important from a political and electoral perspective.
If you had to sum up the book in one or two sentences, what would you say?
People vote in radical ways amongst the white working class because they have developed high expectations of their social, economic, and political status. And those expectations have been supremely disappointed. So the people who are most disappointed, that have the biggest sense of loss, the biggest sense of letdown, are the ones who are the angriest and the ones who are more prone to supporting fringe candidates.
All right, Justin Guest, Assistant Professor of Public Policy at George Mason University in Washington. Thank you so much. Turning now to what's trending online, we are joined live in studio by our fabulous social media guru, G. Abby Lee. Hi, G. What is the word on the web today?
Well, it says that billionaire George Soros is not having a great week so far, and that's because his Open Society Foundation is got hacked, and media reports show hackers stole some 2,500 files from the grant-making network. Soros funds the foundation, and to tell you a little bit about the foundation, it provides millions in grant funding to civic organizations around the world, and it looks like the website DC Leaks published internal files from the organization.
Wow. So Soros is more or less a household name here in America for those listeners that don't know. But tell us briefly about what he's all about.
Sure. So he was born in Hungary as Georges Schwartz, but later anglicized his name to George Soros when he immigrated to England. Now he's a dual citizen in Hungary and America. He's a well-known businessman, investor, and political activist. He's a chairman of Soros Fund Management, and not surprisingly, one of the 30 richest people in the world.
Okay, so because he's a political activist, what side of the political aisle does he lean toward?
He's widely viewed as being on the left side of the spectrum than on the right. And from the online community's response, it's clear that some people compare him to the Koch brothers. The brothers are known for making large financial contributions to libertarian and mostly conservative think tanks and campaigns. They also contribute quite significantly to Republican candidates.
All right. Well, let's delve right into the social media reaction.
Let's do it. WikiLeaks posted this on Facebook. 3,000-plus documents leaked from George Soros' Open Society Foundation, but weak digital curation undermines impact. And the top comment to that post is by a man named Kim Jun-sung. He wrote, "Soros and Hillary leaks proved that Soros and the Rothschild family have been controlling Hillary and Obama." He added, "Soros and the Rothschild family gave orders to former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton." And another commenter named Chuck Schultz wrote, "The scariest thing is how they are trying to make the immigration crisis, quote unquote, the new normal in order to be able to maintain control over global immigration policy."
So what is he saying? Did he respond to the hacking?
No, he is on Twitter, though, at George Soros, but his last tweet is from August 2nd. Lori, back to you.
All right. Thanks so much. You can follow her at G. Abby Lee. We appreciate it. Here are some of the stories we're following around the world and on VOAnews.com. Afghanistan will start or restart a polio vaccine campaign after an IS retreat. The U.S. condemns South Sudan soldiers who raped and killed civilians. An airstrike hits a hospital in Yemen, killing 11. Milwaukee is calmer after protests over a police shooting. And Rio Day 11, American Simone Biles aims for gold in the final gymnastics event. Expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Well, Russia says its bombers Tuesday struck militant targets in Syria from an airbase in Iran. It's believed the first time Russian airplanes or warplanes have done so since launching its air campaign last September in support of President Bashar al-Assad. Russia's defense ministry says long-range bombers and frontline bombers were launched from an airbase southwest of the Iranian capital of Tehran. Alessandra Volucci is the director of the United Nations Information Service in Geneva, and she says her agency has big concern.
The Commission is gravely concerned for the safety of civilians, including a reported 100,000 children living in eastern Aleppo city, where violence has reached new highs in recent weeks as asymmetric warfare intensifies over control of armed group-held neighborhoods and their principal remaining supply lines.
In Aleppo, aid worker Ismail Abdullah points out that airstrikes are a tragic daily routine in the city.
We will hear the bombing. This is the bombing, the sound. This is the sound of bombing. Russian intervention changed the game, and we have a lot of bombing. Targeting civil defense centers, targeted hospitals, targeted schools, targeted markets.
Well, the Syrian conflict began in March 2011 as peaceful protests against President Assad and quickly spiraled into a civil war that the United Nations estimates has killed more than 400,000 people. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Do you know the political process that determines who the next president of the United States will be? Tune in to VOA's extensive coverage of the campaigns, the voting, and the final tallying to find out how citizens choose their next president. Right here on VOA.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news. at the top of each hour, around the clock on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
This is VOA's International Edition. 15 prisoners at Guantanamo Bay have been released to the United Arab Emirates in the single largest transfer of detainees during the Obama administration. The release of 12 Yemeni nationals and three Afghans comes amid a renewed push to whittle down the number of detainees held at the U.S. base in Cuba. President Obama has been seeking to close the detention center amid opposition from Congress. Visiting Georgetown University professor R. Nicholas Palarino, citing remarks on jihadism made Monday by Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump in a policy speech, told VOA's Victor Beatty he questions the wisdom of trying to shut down Guantanamo.
I understand President Obama's thoughts about what Guantanamo Bay is doing to damage U.S. credibility around the world. But you have to contrast that point to many of our leaders believe that we are at war with the jihadist movement around the world. And if you accept that, which many of our leaders do, and many people around the world do, then we should not be releasing these prisoners back into the battlefield. And the battlefield is not only Syria, Iraq, it is around the world at this point. Donald Trump mentioned today how many locations the Islamic State has moved into around the world. And whether these prisoners are going to the UAE or whether they're going to Saudi Arabia or Bahrain or any location around the world, with our globalization, it really doesn't make a difference because they can communicate and spread their ideology all over the world through the internet. So I think President Obama's concept at this point, to me at least, is flawed. We shouldn't be releasing these people back into this global jihadist movement because all they're going to do is further support and bring more recruits through their ideology to the jihadist movements.
He outlined a plan, I guess, in February aimed at shutting that facility, but faces congressional opposition. What can Congress do, if anything?
Congress needs to continue to put pressure on the Obama administration. But one thing they can do right away, and that is pass the authorization to use military force against the Islamic State. And Congress has been dragging their heels on this. They really need to move forward on it. We're either at war with the jihadist movement or we're not. And many believe that we are. And trust me, the jihadist movement believes they're at war with us. So if they believe that, then we should be at war with them.
All right. Palarino says studies have shown that up to 25% of those released return to jihadist activities. Donald Trump says if elected, he'll keep Guantanamo open. Amnesty International has applauded the president's actions. This is VOA's International Edition. While swimmers and racers and gymnasts are competing at the Olympic Games in Rio, violinists and percussionists who've made it to the Olympics of classical music are wowing crowds at Tanglewood, the Boston Symphony Orchestra's summer home in the Berkshire Mountains of Massachusetts. We have more now from Jeff London.
This is a story about a young musician who learned if at first, second, third, or fourth you don't succeed, try harder.
I got close. I got alternate the past 4 years, but it finally took this fifth time.
Many audition, few are selected for the Boston Symphony's elite summer training program. When 25-year-old percussionist Miles Salerni got rejected the third time, he found a different way to get to Tanglewood. He joined the stage crew.
When I arrived, I was under the impression that I would just be moving chairs and percussion instruments and stands and maybe setting up some risers for the orchestra. I had no clue that I was gonna be climbing, 45 feet in the air, trying to feed a rope through a pulley.
He got up on the catwalk and about halfway down, completely froze, and said, I don't think I can do this.
John Demick is the BSO's stage manager.
But he did. And you know what? I would hire him again today.
The musicians felt the same way, says percussionist Kyle Brightwell.
Miles kind of knew everything that was going on in the percussion section, and so we took advantage of that a little bit. And hey, Miles, can you grab us the tambourine? Hey, Miles, can you go grab us that Grover triangle clip that goes on the suspended cymbal stand? We could say that to him, and he would know what to look for.
And during those two seasons when Miles Salerni wasn't looking for Grover triangle clips, he listened and learned.
I, most of the time, went out into the audience during the rehearsals or the concerts and would try and just soak in as much as I could.
Fast forward to the summer of 2016. And the happy ending. After five tries, Salerni is finally a fellow. He got to play snare drum with his peers and the BSO on the 1812 Overture.
It's very exposed and it was nerve-wracking, but very, very fun.
Miles Salerni's former boss, John Demick, says the stage crew misses him, but they're thrilled.
For us, it's incredible. I mean, once I found out that Miles actually made it through, I may have been the first person to call him to congratulate him.
And Salerni says,
I do miss the guys back at the stage crew, don't get me wrong, but yeah, there's something special about creating music, especially with a young group of enthusiastic musicians.
For VOA News, I'm Jeff London in Lenox, Massachusetts.
Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Lori London in Washington. I hope to hear you or see you again next time. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
A living nightmare is how Deputy Secretary of State Antony Blinken described life for religious and ethnic minorities in Iraq and Syria under the barbarous, genocidal regime of Daesh. Speaking at a Washington conference on the threat posed to these communities, Mr. Blinken said there is grave concern over their very survival. He noted, however, that the global coalition's momentum against Daesh is growing and has led to a significant liberation of territory held by the terrorist group, a cut in their financing, a diminution of the flow of their foreign fighter recruits, and the elimination of thousands of their leaders. But more needs to be done. Iraqi forces, he said, are preparing for the greatest battle against Daesh to date, the liberation of the Iraqi city of Mosul and the surrounding Nineveh plains. Deputy Secretary Blinken stressed that the twin responsibilities of military victory and inclusive political and economic progress must proceed together in lockstep. Mr. Blinken noted that Mosul holds a unique place in Iraqi history and identity. For thousands of years, Christians, Yazidis, Turkmen, Sunni, Shabak, Kurds, Shia, all have made this ancient city their home. He called the area the cradle of civilization, rich in ancient cultural artifacts, but most importantly, representative of Iraq's cultural infrastructure of pluralism and diversity. He emphasized the importance of the Iraqi government's providing a fundamental accommodation in which all of Iraq's communities believe they have a future in Iraq.
All Iraqis, be they Sunni, Shia, Kurd, Christian, or any other, have to be convinced that the state that they've been asked to fight for, the state they've been asked to remain a part of, will stand up for their rights and their equities, that they can advance their interests more effectively as citizens of a united Iraq than as supplicants of other regional powers or members of isolated competitive blocs in a fractured and weakened state.
Deputy Secretary Blinken observed that the real wealth of a nation is defined not by its size or military prowess, but by its human resources. Countries that invest in the health, in the prosperity, in the security, in the diversities of their societies will thrive in the 21st century. That is the future. And with international assistance, it is the future, Deputy Secretary Blinken said, that the Iraqis can make possible for their communities and for their country.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.